With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
There was a time I was so afraid, so scared to do what I wanted. In looking back, I can see all the mistakes that I made, and I wish that I could talk to me and tell me I can change. Don't be afraid, just walk with your head.
Hi, welcome to Blog Talk Radio, Safe Recovery. This is Monica, and I'm your host. Tonight is February 19th, 2013. Welcome to Safe Recovery on Blog Talk Radio. You can find me on iTunes for free as well and download all the previous episodes. We're coming up on almost 2 years in March, the end of March 25th. I'll celebrate 2 years on Blog Talk Radio. Wow, I can't believe it. And over 62,000 downloads and hits and listens. I'm really excited to still be doing this show and really having fun doing it and feel like I need to do it. We have a really great guest tonight. We have Stephen Slate, who is the owner of the blog, The Clean Slate. Stephen is an addiction treatment counselor. I guess you're going to correct me. It's probably not the right word. Stephen, right? Counselor. And is also connected with St. Jude's Retreat. I am way too multitasking right now, looking at different tabs here. I want to read a story, so we will introduce Stephen in just a minute. We're going to talk about a couple things tonight. We're going to talk about Stephen's blog and his connection with St. Jude's. But there's a couple of stories in the news, one being country singer Mindy McCready, dead of an apparent suicide. She took her life this past week, and there's a lot of talk all over the place about it, and I find it pretty disturbing myself, which is why I put it up on my blog, Leaving AA. I was really touched by it. I was a real fan of country music, and as I read this story, it made me really want to get the word out that there's other ways. And was she offered other ways? Was she treated like a 37-year-old adult and not a child? Was she given the options and told? I do know that she was on celebrity rehab, so now we have, I think it's 3 or 4 people killed themselves who have been on celebrity rehab, so maybe we need to have anti-not-celebrity rehab. Another show that maybe can enlighten the world that there's something else besides AA and 12-step. So I really would like that to happen. McCready's body was found about 3:30 p.m. Sunday on the front porch of her home in Heber Springs, Arkansas, with a single gunshot wound. And the Cleburne County Sheriff's Office confirmed to Yahoo, and deputies responded to a 911 call reporting the gunfire. McCready apparently shot her dog before returning the gun on herself. Her body was transported to the Arkansas State Crime Lab for an autopsy, and her death is being probed, the sheriff says. McCready's apparent suicide comes just a little more than a month after the death of her boyfriend, songwriter David Wilson, 34. The death of Wilson, who fathered McCready's younger son, is still under investigation. It was after Wilson's death that McCready, who struggles with drugs and alcohol, were chronicled, what is this word here, on VH1 Celebrity Rehab. I swear to God, anyway, was committed to a psychiatric hospital, and her two children, 6-year-old and 9-month-old, were removed from her care. So I'm sure that didn't happen either. That didn't help her either. But emotional problems and substance abuse and difficult relationships took their toll. By the time of her final release in 2010, I'm Still Here, that's the song, she was better known for Celebrity Rehab than her recordings. What does that say about our society and Celebrity Rehab? I think that's enough. I'm going to bring Stephen on. Hello, Stephen.
Hey.
Hi.
How are you, Monica?
I'm good. A little nasally still from my cold, but otherwise really good. And how you doing?
Good.
Welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you here.
I'm glad to be here, too. I hadn't heard that story about the suicide. I know you mentioned it before,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't know all the details. And now that you mention it, I think I did see her on Celebrity Rehab. Because I have watched a few episodes of that here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a disturbing show.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, I tried to watch Intervention, I think I watched it twice, but, and this is like before I was leaving AA, and I was like really like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And it's sort of impossible for me to watch, but anyway, so tell me your thoughts about this.
You know, I think a lot of people, you know, there's people that commit suicide everywhere at all times and places, and you know, I think it's horrible. You said that so she was really obviously steeped in the 12 steps. I think that, you know, I'm not gonna say she committed suicide because of that influence directly, but I think there is something to be said for all of the powerlessness talk,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that can add to somebody's hopelessness for
mm-hmm.
sure.
Mm-hmm.
And their belief that things won't get better. So.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what's your take?
Well, my take is, I mean, I don't, I was around in AA for a long time, and I think I only know one person not in that community that killed themselves, and I know way too many. I have more than one hand. People have committed
yeah.
suicide in the AA community, including people I knew in Hawaii. And I think the only friend that I had was a childhood friend, and it was true mental breakdown, and there was, as far as I know, no stepping involved in that. And everything else in Hawaii and California was all, you know, 12-step related, including my ex-brother-in-law, who took his life a year and a half ago, and I would say very related to 12-step failure. And
yeah.
I think the part that's so disturbing is watching Dr. Drew last night, which I don't watch. I watched it because of this show, you know, this story, and the type of people that he had on. There were three or four people up on the screen, and they all looked like they were drones, or they were like, I don't know what, but they didn't look like the people that was on the Huff Live last night with Stanton Peel and the woman who wrote the book Inside Rehab. And they were having a real discussion about the other choices and why don't people talk about that. And Stanton said, well, it's like, you know, AA people are like the jealous lover. Like, you can't say in an AA meeting, well, you know, if this doesn't work, you know, I heard about a smart recovery meeting or an SOS meeting, or you can go to St. Jude's and not to the Betty Ford Center if you don't want to get... and they were talking about facts that I didn't know about how people are not trained who are mostly working in rehabs, like how little training they have. They don't have a like you have to work in the health field and any other field. Like the stats are, if you don't, if anyone's listening to this and you don't know this, last night on Huffington Live, it was an incredible dialogue between that reporter and Stanton Peel and the woman, her name is Fletcher, Ann Fletcher, who wrote Inside Rehab, and the guy who wrote the Kraft book. I can't remember his name either. I'm just pulling up. And anyway, it really was a really fantastic talk about why wouldn't anybody want to tell or hear their names. So there was Dr. Robert Myers was on, and he's connected with the Kraft program with SMART, that's for family and friends of people who are having a problem, and M. Fletcher, who wrote Inside Rehab, and Clancy Martin, who is a professor from the University of Missouri, and of course Stanton. But it's just too much everywhere, you know, Stephen. This talk about that it's the only way, and the powerlessness, and the punitive treatment, like our kids were taken away. I don't know that it was 12-step. It just smells like a rat. It just smells like it to me. And from somebody who was in it for over 3 decades, I'm not always right, but there's a lot of time that if I'm reading the story, you can read into it, right? And I think that, you know, there certainly is a lot of talk on Leaving AA, that blog, about it. But I think that's why when I first started this radio show, Stephen, that I didn't know a lot of you. I was beginning to get to know people from the blog Stinkin' Thinkin'. And I went from exposing AA to wanting to get the word out that there were these other choices. And I, in the process, you know, my own sons were freed from AA nut job, wacko, 1939 insanity. And I, you know, began to read the books that Gunther told me about. I didn't even know who Albert Ellis was. I didn't know who Stanton Peel was. I met him. I met you. So let's, for anyone who's listening, Stephen Slate is a addiction coach. He has his own blog, and he works with St. Jude's Retreat in New York, and Stephen has an office in Lower Manhattan. And one of the first questions I want to ask you is, why did you create the blog, The Clean Slate, in the beginning?
You know, there's a few reasons why I started the blog. I, you know, first of all, just my bio is basically, I had a problem with drugs. I got into treatment, and that my problem got worse and worse. And for about 5 years, I was going to conventional, a lot of programs, a lot of conventional treatment programs, AA, NA, and CA, and, you know, methadone and inpatient, outpatient counseling. And, you know, I got hooked up with a bunch of therapists and counselors and psychiatrists and meds and, you know, all of it. And, you know, and I proceeded to get worse and worse in that world. My parents had found this St. Jude retreat, and as I said, look, I'm not going to another program. They're going to tell me the same things. I'm going to get out. I'm still going to want to get high. Like, that's going to be with me forever. You know, I got to the point where I really believed that I was going to be stuck with that forever, especially since I didn't believe in God, you know? And that was kind of like a prerequisite to, you know, having the miracle happen where maybe the obsession was lifted from you. But, you know, so anyways, I did that and I finally turned things around. And you know, eventually I started working for the St. Jude Retreat and I did all that. Did that for a few years and I moved. I wanted to get out of upstate New York, really. Yeah. And I moved to the city, and I was pursuing some other things, but I, like, continued to write and write and write. I was trying to write my own book on recovery. And, you know, I wasn't really finishing it. You know, so part of writing the blog was like, look, I'm writing this stuff, and I got to get it out there and see what people think of it.
Right.
You know? And the blog has really gone in the direction of being mostly just a polemic on is addiction a disease or not. And certainly that's not everything that I was working on, but that's the main sort of issue I'm tackling there, because it was the main difference in approach for me.
Yeah.
Which is I was told, you know, this is out of your control because it's a disease again and again and again. And I proceeded to behave, you know, more and more like I was out of control. And these people at St. Jude said, you're not out of control. You're in control.
Mm-hmm.
You are doing this just because you like the feeling of the drug. It's that simple. It doesn't have to be, you know, a more convoluted explanation than that. You like the feeling of it. That's why you're doing it. And if you think you might want to try liking the feeling of life better in other ways, you know, you can do that. It's your choice. And so, you know, so that's the message I've settled on with the blog is to really, you know, and maybe the blog posts are sometimes too, you know, wordy. You know, I don't know if it's the most readable thing at times, but I explore
that.
Looks
pretty good, though. I'm looking at it.
I think it's important for people, you know, if they want to, if they're questioning the disease concept, they can question it on my blog. I mean, there's a lot of posts there that deal specifically with that. You know, and I started to get good feedback from it. And I started to hear from some of the people on Stinkin' Thinkin', and I eventually heard from Stanton, and I worked with him a little bit for a while. And my people up at St. Jude's got back in touch with me. So we're reading your blog. We love it. You know, come work with us. I wanted to get that message out there. I wanted to write for people and see if they found it helpful or useful. And I get a lot of haters on the blog, but I get a lot of really positive feedback from people, too, which is wonderful.
Really?
People have told me they find it.
How
yeah,
come I never hear from you when you get the haters? you could send me an email and we'll put a grab a bunch of us to come over and fight the haters over there on your on the clean slate. We stick together as anti-steppers, you know.
You know the post that has attracted a lot of attention lately?
What?
It's a piece I put up a long time ago just about the allergy model, you know. And people are, you know, jumping on there saying, you know, you're wrong, it's an allergy, and they're not really offering reasons why. Just mainly like, well, because Dr. Silkworth said so. But, you know, nothing about the allergy thing is only, a metaphor, you know. And I think it's a bad metaphor, personally, because, you know, The idea is, right, you get a little bit of this substance in you and it kicks off this domino effect, right? You know?
Right.
And, you know, the epidemiological data shows that most people eventually become moderate drinkers. So if they have the allergy, you know, how do they do that? If it's a real medical allergy, you know? And then the other thing is they've done studies where they've given alcoholics alcohol unbeknownst to them, and you know, they didn't, it was mixed in with like tonic water to a degree where you couldn't taste it, and they didn't keep on drinking, you know.
If
it's like because they didn't know,
right,
there was, and when they knew that there was alcohol in it, they drank a lot more.
And even
when they did that and there wasn't alcohol, but they were told there was alcohol in it, they drank a bunch more.
Oh, yeah, this thread has
a
lot of comments on it. This is really a lot of, that's a pretty busy thread. I just picked up the one you said, addiction as an allergy, loss of control.
Yeah,
there's a lot of comments there.
There are.
Yeah, I went to a doctor, new doctor recently because of the cold I had, and it was a young Asian guy, and he said to me, I started talking to him about what I was doing and my radio show and I was making a film, and he said that he said the thing with the Asians, he was Asian, and he if he takes even just a couple of sips, he gets a headache right away. I mean, a really bad headache, and so I said, well, what is that? And he said it's an enzyme in the blood, that some mm-hmm. people have this enzyme, it's different than someone else, that makes it, you know, he didn't call it an allergy. Interesting, you know, I think that I was told that it was an allergy, the mental obsession, what's A's terminology, an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind, and, you know, you're sick to the core. And I think that language from the 1930s that's never, ever been revised is disgusting, and it is harmful, and it's, really, really deadly. And I don't mince words about it because I was in it for too long, and I feel like it gives me the right to speak however I want about it. I certainly did way too much service involved in it,
yeah.
You know. Gunther is asking, can he add the clean slate to resource page at Expose AA? Stephen, one of the person in the chat room, Gunther's asking. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah. I love that.
Yeah, he
yeah.
said, sure, Gunther, go ahead, put it in there. Yeah, they have, so Expose AA, if anyone's listening and doesn't know it, expaa.org, has become a really good resource. I would say that it's definitely X-Steppers, and there's a lot of good resources there that if
yeah.
anybody's looking for it, yeah, it's a good website, as well as NA Daytona, which brings up a lot of the news, and then you have mine at leavingaa.com and Step 13 Step. So
I have you linked. I'll have to link those other ones as well.
I like
what your doctor said. I mean, I don't want to stick on this forever, but
yeah.
I did want to mention, like, he's talking about, if anything is an allergy, it would be closer to that. Like, he gets a headache.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't run out and start drinking more.
No, he doesn't
right?
want to. Yeah, he actually doesn't
yeah,
like to drink.
You go,
yeah.
If you really had an allergy,
mm-hmm.
it would be bad. You would feel, like, you wouldn't drink more. That would be the last thing on your mind. I mean, there are people that are literally allergic to alcohol, and they get sick. You know, they don't drink more. They get sick.
Right,
And there's, you know, there's a huge difference. And, you know, I think it's just silly. The whole allergy thing is silly. And it sets people up as they're this set of precariously placed dominoes. It's just ready to fall, be knocked down at any moment. And I like you said, I think it's downright harmful for people to conceive of themselves in that way. And we're teaching them that. It's horrible.
Well, I mean, you listen to your story. I mean, I knew, we've talked many times, and, you know, I think,
yeah.
I didn't realize, I mean, I remember when we were walking, you know, in the city last summer, and we met for the first time, and you were sort of telling me more of your story in a personal way. I mean, I really got it. I was like, wow, like, it's like Amy's story, like 20 years in and out and around this stuff, and you're like 5 years of you trying, and it getting worse. You know, if you're getting worse.
I literally got worse and worse. I went, you know, I had been snorting heroin. You know, I've been using heroin nasally
mm-hmm.
for like 2 to 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I got arrested buying some heroin, and I had to go to a rehab, and I went to High Watch Farm in Connecticut.
Oh, my
and,
God. High Watch Farm, isn't that like the big oldest stepper place? Is that it? That place?
It is. Bill, some nuns gave it to Bill Wilson, and he started. Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
So it's real. It was like 7 various kinds of 12-step meetings a day that we had there. And
oh my God!
You know, I was just told repeatedly by both staff and by the other, you know, AA members that were there, because they had relapsed yet again,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, this line of, you're not done yet. And, oh, you're just sniffing heroin. You're not done. You're going to be shooting it. And I had really, like, kept a limit for myself and said, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm never going to do that. I'm not going to inject drugs.
Right.
And it was just, beaten into my head that you're going to do that. Everybody does it. You're not done. You'll be shooting up soon. You know, in a place that's supposed to be helping me.
Yeah, this
is
really
what I'm getting. And I, you know, I certainly the choice was my own. Okay.
Right.
But within a week of leaving that place, after 3 years of using nasally, within a week of leaving that place, I was shooting up. You know, that was my first rehab.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
I mean, that's exponentially worse. You know.
Yeah.
And you know, it got really bad from there. You know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I'm really. One of the bloggers said today, well, that actually, somebody said some really crappy stuff to me, and then the blogger said, "Wow, this is the reason why I left. I'm actually glad there were people like this in AA. You know, the controlling, punitive, arrogant, judgmental buttholes that think they know everything and." Anyway, what's it Gunther wrote here? People addicted to peanuts don't crave peanuts.
What? Funny.
People addicted to peanuts. I don't know. I'm not addicted to peanuts, but there's a certain kind of Haagen-Dazs ice cream, and if it's around, I'll eat it. Vanilla bean or coffee chip or whatever the favorite one my son has. Okay, how long has the blog been up?
I started it. In, I think, the spring of 2010.
Oh, okay.
So
timing,
we're getting to just about 3 years with it. In a couple months, it'll be about 3 years I've had it up there.
So ours started a similar time. I started mine in January of 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Began the work. Ilsa started Sinkin' Thinking a year prior to that. It's really interesting. Okay, and I want to ask you this. Why, I already asked you that, but science-based approach, what science-based approach do you use?
Where are you reading that quote from?
No, I'm asking you, like, I'm sorry, if I've been sick for a week and a half, or what approach do you, I mean, I know, but our listeners don't know, so what?
Yeah.
What approach? I know you don't use the 12 steps, Stephen, right? You're not going to
We don't use the 12 steps. we have developed our own approach. We call it cognitive behavioral education.
Mm-hmm.
And we essentially teach people principles of human behavior and choice and those naturally play into how people make choices about substance use.
Mm-hmm.
And we teach them how to enlarge their range of options. And so, you know, what happens when you do the St. Jude program is the first 9 chapters of the textbook are a lot of ideas and theory and you're learning, you know, how to look at human behavior and choices differently. And the theory that we present that it's based on is we call it the freedom model philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And it basically boils down to all people freely act in ways that they believe will bring them the greatest amount of happiness.
Mm-hmm.
So we're saying that people do what they think will make them happy. Everything in life that you do, you think it's because it's your sort of best option at that time to get some kind of happiness. Now, this doesn't mean that things don't backfire and that certain choices are, you know, in the long run bad, you know.
Right.
That's certainly a part of things. We're not saying that every choice makes you happy. We're saying that the drive behind the choices is happiness. And, for instance, you know, I remember really being at a point where I thought, kind of the best thing that I can do, because everything else I do in life, I keep failing at, But getting high makes me feel good right now, you know. And really, and so in a way, it becomes my best viable option. It's what I'm willing to do,
mm-hmm.
and it's what, when I compare it to other things, looks the best. And you know, maybe I'm now getting a little too deep into that. But so we, you know, that's our philosophy. We teach that. Everything else is sort of based around it.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that if, you know, people can recognize that you use substances because they offer a small moment of happiness, and you can embrace it on that level. And trust me, that's hard for some people, because I get some that have been, you know, in treatment and 12-step programs for a long time. They come in and they say, I don't even know why I drink anymore. I don't even like it.
Mm.
Have you heard that? You know,
yeah.
I don't know why I was even doing it. I didn't like it. And people are at a point where they're believing, and I think it's because, mostly because they hear this. It's a narrative out there. I don't even like it. If somebody's stuck there, and that comes from the disease concept in a way, because the disease concept, you know, sort of divorces behavior from purpose. You know, it says that you just have this disease that's pushing you. Nothing to do with, you know, you're not choosing this. But if you can really get to a place where you're honestly embracing that, look, I just do this for a moment of happiness. Okay, that's great. That's step one, in a way, you know, like, let's look at it that simply. The next part is, if you can start exploring your other options in life and realize that it is just momentary happiness that you're getting out of it, you might decide that you'd get longer lasting happiness or higher levels of happiness from subtracting that from your life and maybe doing some other things. And what is the science behind this, if that was the question? This was when they started the St. Jude program 22 years ago, I think it was. They took AA and they just did one tweak on it. They said, you don't have a disease. You're not out of control. You're just doing this because it makes you happy. If you want, you can do other things. They did that from going in and looking at, they looked at AA meetings in the upstate area.
Right.
And studied it themselves, and they figured out that there was a 10% success rate. They took a group of 30 people initially, taught them this twist on AA, and they got a 75% success rate.
Mm-hmm.
So the science is that we had an idea, we tested it, it worked. And then from there, we've developed it. One of the founders of the retreat, both of them lived in this retreat for 10 years. And I have amazing respect for that. They lived in there trying to help people, always on the verge of bankruptcy, you know, really just staying alive by a thread.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of researchers, you know, they don't really know what questions to ask. But living in that environment like that helps you figure out what questions to ask. If you get my drift, you know, you can't just sort of sit in a lab and come up with studies in the same way as if you're working directly every day trying to help people,
mm-hmm.
and you see what they react to and what they don't, and you're living with them at the time. I mean, that gives you an incredible sort of insight into what's going on. It gives you a better idea of what questions to ask. And you know, of course, you know, we've studied all the research that's out there, the existing research. That's one of my main functions, is to analyze the research that comes out and figure out how we can use it to help people. We do all of that as well.
Ooh.
So
in your research, do you have any neuroscientists to disprove or prove that it is not a brain disease, because I really have a problem with that and don't believe it is. And it certainly isn't if it's, you know, if it's...
I don't... Yeah, we know people who've had real brain disease. This, this is not a brain disease. And I think... I have listed on the front page of my blog, if you scroll down to the bottom, there's a little section that says for brain disease skeptic.
Uh-huh.
And I link to an article that this guy, Mark Lewis, who is a neuroscientist, wrote an article in, I think it was December or November, and it basically makes the same argument that I make on my site. But, of course, I'm not a neuroscientist, but I finally found somebody who came up with the same opinion as me, which is that the brain changes that, that go on in an, you know, quote, that if,
right.
Are just, they represent learning, you know, and they're plastic and they can change and change again. Obviously, there's some toxicity effects, but those go away over time as people dry out. But a lot of the, like, changes in levels of activity in various parts of the brain, you know, that's what happens when you learn.
Right,
you know,
right.
So there's a difference between learning and disease. You know, if you look on my site and you scroll down, you'll see that a link to that article by Mark Lewis, and that's worth taking a look at.
Yeah, I think so. I'm on there now, but I wasn't on the front page. I was trying to find... where it was, as I'm back here now. So let me see. So I'm on the front page, and then go to the right side. Is that where? What's this thing about Colin Farrell and Manchild Mature?
No, it's on the left side.
Oh, on the left side? Okay.
Yeah.
Latest articles? Oh, my nose is getting all dual diagnosis.
If you scroll all the way down to the bottom, that is where you'll find it.
Okay. Addiction is not a brain disease there. Why addiction is not
I'm
a brain disease?
I'm trying to pull up the page in front of me. I don't even have it right now.
No,
there's
that's
a
okay.
Says,
oh, I found it. I found it. Yeah.
For brain disease skeptics. And,
right.
And I go through several links there, and there's a big quote from Mark Lewis, and there's a link to his article, Why Addiction is Not a Brain Disease.
Uh-huh,
you know,
like
people
this.
Think I'm not credible because I'm not a neuroscientist. They can look at what he says and he comes up with the same opinion. So
yeah. Okay. I think I'll put it on my front page. I like this. Thank you. I'm on the Clean Slate, and you go to the bottom, and there's a highlighted part. So Why Addiction is Not a Brain Disease by Mark Lewis. And maybe he was in another film. I saw a film where there was a doctor, and he was just, you know, they shake their heads and they go like, "What? What are people saying?" I think that's. The whole part is that it's become a billion-dollar industry, and so, of course, they'd want to, you know, talk about it as a disease so they can get insurance to cover it.
Yeah.
And then that brings us to another story that's on the front page of your blog, which is dual diagnosis. Do you want to attack that at all?
Yeah, I do, and I want to be careful to just mention first, you know, when saying this, I'm not questioning anybody's mental health problem, saying that they're illegitimate.
Yeah, this is a different point of view,
And
you're taking it from what doctors are saying. So, okay,
you have
a disclaimer.
There was an article that came out the other day. I'll just tell you myself, when I went into the rehab, I was, you know, given every diagnosis, you know, social anxiety disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, chronic dysthymia or depression, and bipolar, you know.
Wow.
And, you know, a lot of people have this experience, you know, and this is the big thing now. We need dual diagnostic clinics, you know, and everything. Well, this, you know, I mean, I got over those things in time, and I wasn't, you know, I had ceased getting any treatment for those things and really just got over them as they changed my life, and I'm not telling anybody to stop treatment for those things.
Right.
You know, do whatever you think you have to do. But the reason I thought this article in NewJersey.com was interesting the other day is it's got a whole bunch of quotes from parents and from people that are working in the clinics that where people are going in to get, you know, treatment for addiction, and the, you know, intake people, the nurses and counselors, et cetera, are saying to them, hey, you know, why don't you fake a mental illness here?
Wow.
Because if you do that, you're more likely to get the insurance company to pay for this.
Oh, my God.
You know, so, you know, there's a quote where they say, this was amazing, where the nurse said to him, said to this family, you know, would your son be willing to say that he was going to harm his mother or himself? And you know, they said that if he was mentally unstable, they could admit him. And his insurance would cover that. This is a boy who was, an 18-year-old boy who was doing heroin. And, you know, they said, that's not good enough. You know, you got to say that you also have a mental illness.
Wow.
I think that's kind of crazy. So now what complications does that bring into things? And, you know, I've heard this from many other people. I haven't ever really seen it, you know, documented like it was in this article where they had a lot of interviews and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, they have, you know, some little statements from other people saying it's normal. Healthcare experts say scenes like this have become far too common.
Oh my God.
You know, so what complications does that bring in when somebody is given psychiatric meds, perhaps, that they don't need, you know? And what complication does it bring in when people start to believe that they have all these added psychiatric problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then the particular thing I looked at in this article, or that I brought up, is what about when we look at the statistics on addiction? Because one explanation that's offered up why people who go to rehabs do worse than those who don't,
mm-hmm.
which is the truth.
Right.
That, you know, you have a better chance of sobering up if you actually don't get treatment from some account. One of the possible explanations is, well, there's more comorbidity among people that go to treatment centers, meaning more people are dually diagnosed. Not only do they have addiction, but they also have, you know, bipolar or depression, anxiety disorders, etc. Well, here we have some evidence. I mean, I've heard it plenty anecdotally. And here we have, you know, it's coming up in the news that, you know, people are, you know, blatantly, you know, coming up with fraudulent mental illnesses in order to get insurance to cover it, you know. And I'm not attacking them for doing that. I'm saying, but well, now we've got to look at all these numbers that
right.
say that the treatment population supposedly has more mental health issues. That may not be true once you subtract all of the fraud going on in order, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then from there, we got to explain, okay, well, why do people do worse once they go to treatment programs? And, you know, I think the answer is obvious, and I'm not the first one to say it. Being taught that, you know, you are this precariously placed set of dominoes ready to be knocked down maybe isn't all that good for you. You know, I mean, I think that's what it really is. I think that's the difference. And so I'm just bringing this up, you know, to sort of be like, hey, you know, maybe this comorbidity argument to explain away why people do worse in rehab, maybe it doesn't really hold the water. Now, I don't know. I don't have, like, you know,
well, that's what woman who was on the Huffington Live last night, who wrote the new book Inside Rehab, and what she was saying is that most people did well on their own. More people
mm-hmm.
actually went for just a day where they don't stay overnight. There was a lot
yeah.
of that. And so, I mean, I think I am going to get the book just to see, but there was a lot of talk about that didn't help, and the way that our media and shows like, you know, Dr. Drew and stuff was on, like, especially last night, talking about, well, she didn't want to go, and, well, you know, it's talked about like it's a recipe for making bread. That's, I mean, the part I problem I have with it is that I knew many people who had different kinds of problems, from anything at all, any kind of drug problem and alcohol, and nobody
yeah.
went to rehab. Nobody. And it wasn't, you know, there were very few, and it was
mm-hmm.
very expensive, and it was before the laws were, and I'm finding out now that those laws have been around a lot longer than I knew. I mean, I thought 1980 was, but something I know did happen in the late 70s and early 80s to change insurance and how they paid for it, but it does go back quite a ways from doing the research for my film, because Bill Wilson, you know, was in front of the Senate, and Marty Mann
yeah.
did everything she could, so to, you know, just get doctors.
Yeah, there was,
people.
You know, I think it's amazing if you ever look, I don't know if it's still up, but on the NCADD's website, which is Marty Mann's organization,
mm-hmm.
they had like a timeline. And it really just outlines like a propaganda campaign that they did over a course of 50 years.
Yeah.
And talks about how, you know, she got senators. She went after and she actually got people. She got actors to do like commercials. She got Nixon to make, I think it was, or Eisenhower. I'm all mixed up on that. She got somebody to do an Alcoholism Information Week. She got Alfred Hitchcock Presents to do an episode with an alcoholism storyline.
Wow.
You know, they went after, really, you know, media and politicians.
Yeah.
Push this message. Crazy.
NCADD is not a government agency. This is,
no.
This is my understanding, thanks to J.R. Harris, one of the bloggers, that I've learned. Here's a fact.
No, you're talking about, if I'm thinking of the right thing, it's the National Council on
Addiction
or Alcohol, and I don't know. I don't know the exact acronym, but it was originally like the NCA.
Right,
National Alcoholism.
Right, it was just.
And Marty Mann started it. Yeah.
Right, right. It's hers. It's National Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence. They changed the name because, you know, it wasn't hip to. Didn't want to use the word
alcohol.
Yeah, I think that using the word alcoholism is still very old fashioned, and that it's my opinion that very few people have alcoholism in today's world. I would say that even in AA. Now that I've left and been gone a couple of years, the viewpoint of, you know, there's alcohol abuse, alcohol dependence, which is definitely, you know, used in a clinical sense, but to say alcoholism, you know, I would say 1%, that's even in AA.
Yeah.
Really, I mean, Bill Wilson, variety of alcoholism, give me a break. I mean, all those young people, and I was shocked, I forget which blog that we found this out, that they went after, in the late 1960s, after, never mind high schools, they were in my grade school, and all of us bloggers realized that we had somebody visit us from AA and NA in the 1960s. That's insane.
Yeah.
You're going to go after, you're going to make, you know, Finding Nemo, and now Wreck-It Ralph. You know, my husband's like, no, Monica, that's really not a pro AA film. They're saying that the guy didn't need to go back to the meeting. This is a new animated film, and I'm like, yeah, but, you know, you make these references to sitting in these groups, and people think this is a natural setting.
Yeah.
And I really have a problem with it. I think that, and this whole snow job of let's go after the youth, how about teach the youth about moderation? Let's teach them, oh, here's something you might really like. So one of the guys who was talking last night on Huff Live said, if you don't teach people how to communicate and talk differently, they don't change either.
Uh-huh.
And that's the big thing in AA. Like, they have really poor social skills. If you see people who sit in meetings, and that's why I think people, when they're at 20 years of abstinence, go stark raving mad. I mean, that's an extreme, okay? Because I could be, you know, they are crazy. Like, I know a guy who took his truck and drove into a tree for 21 years because he didn't know how to deal with his anger, because NA never told him, he never learned anything about how to deal with feelings of rage, or when, you know, somebody cheated on you, then that's what, you know, how are you going to communicate?
Yeah.
And I've seen women get really tweaked around those years. All those women who didn't do therapy and didn't go find some other kind of help, like the telling of the story, even I heard this woman, she was fantastic on Ken Anderson's show once about, and they call it like, I forget the name of the therapy, but it's like the story that you tell about yourself over and over again matters.
It does.
They're all repeating, right? You know, they're this stuff, and, you know, while we were talking, I saw this book that I have here on that was right on the couch here, and it's Daniel, Dr. Amen. And it's really funny. There's this change your brain, you know, and it says brain don'ts. This is, like, really bad for your brain. You want to hear a few of them?
Yeah.
Okay. Think in black or white terms. Think in words like always, never, every time, everyone. Focus on the negative things in your life. Predict the worst, which happens at every meeting. Every fucking meeting. Those nut jobs are predicting jails, institutions, and death. Think only with your feelings. Try to read other people's minds. Blame other people for your problem. Label yourself or others with negative terms. Beat up yourself or others with guilt. Personalize situations that have little to do with you. I mean, it's just like, be around.
It's just a total description of what
I know.
You
it's
learn.
From Dr. Amen's book, Change Your Brain, Change Your Life, New York Times bestseller. Yeah, it's just in the back of the book.
Check out that book.
I don't know why I just picked it up. It was weird as we were talking. I was sitting here and
Well, you know, I think that's some of the stuff. It's some of the stuff we help people to deal with in the St. Jude program. You know, we have them do something. We have them do a self-analysis, and it's, you know, it used to be more like a fourth step, and we've really developed it over the years. And it's about looking, you know, at some of those things. Like, okay, so, you know, these bad things have happened in your life, whatever, and you have this narrative about it that you tell yourself. And can you go back and try to look at it from another angle? And it doesn't mean, you know, blame yourself for everything. But it's like, look at, you know, what have your thoughts been about these incidents in your life over the years, you know? What were your cognitive choices and your behavioral choices? You look at both, you know, and it's like if you feel like, it's not designed for you to come up with an amends list or anything like that.
Right.
It's designed for you to probe into, you know, well, you know, here's what I thought. I labeled myself. I did this thing that it didn't work out, and I just labeled myself as a loser and incapable from it. And the result has been, you know, well, you know, I haven't tried to, you know, get a new job since then. Or, you know, I'm speaking in very broad terms right now, but we're asking people to say, you know, how have you maybe limited yourself with, like, that list of things that you were just reading off.
Yeah.
You know?
And
let's look at that. Let's look at the real results and then decide if you want to keep those habits. Almost the exact ones that, I mean, we don't list them off in that way, but it's everything that you were just saying, which is really, you know, that's like a lot of the work that Martin Seligman has done with positive psychology. It's look at what they call explanatory style.
Uh-huh.
And what is it that you tell yourself about the events of your life? Because it matters. You know, if you tell yourself, that this time that you, you know, you burnt the grilled cheese you were trying to make, if you tell yourself that,
right,
oh my God, I'm a horrible cook, right? And you take that, you screwed up one thing and you turn it into, I can't cook anything, right? You know,
right, well, right.
You're gonna order out from now on.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
I think Hank Hayes, You've Been Lied To, that book that Hank wrote, he deals with that negative self-talk that even when I first met him, you know, trying, this is the part about deprogramming when you leave, if you've,
yeah,
you know, I think if you've been it at any length of time, but for those people who are in it a long time, I think it takes a couple of years to deprogram. But he talks about even saying exactly like that, like, oh, I'm so fat or I'm so stupid, you catch yourself, that it's really harmful, you know, that negative self-talk,
yeah,
and it has to be, it's a habit, it's a bad habit.
It is, and that's why, you know, and that is the whole thing about the 12-step program. Self-talk, negative self-talk is built into the first step, you know?
Mm-hmm.
My life is unmanageable, and I am powerless, however it goes. Those two things, those two thoughts, wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty negative.
Yeah, it's really negative. And the thing that I'm a little upset about lately is that I went to see the Bill Wilson documentary, you know, just to see it, and people have really misconstrued, it's been really twisted and turned. It was not a design for living. I don't know if they say that all over the country, but in California, at least my design for living. I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this was designed, people are using this to deal with childhood abuse and sexual abuse. These two nutbags in their suits, middle-aged men, were the worst of the worst, kind of, they were real chronic alcoholics. They found an answer to that. That's it. That's what the six steps were for. How to stop drinking when nothing
mm-hmm.
worked for them. It was nothing about your childhood. It was nothing about, they were both, you know, poor communicators. You know, Dr. Bob, you know, beat his kids, you know, sober. They gave people strong drugs to come off the heavy drinking that they did back then. They didn't do it, you know, on the complete natch like Amy Winehouse did.
Yeah.
It killed her, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, seeing the film, you just see how it's like a lot of it's distorted. And you, I don't know. I just think that the more we get out the word about what, you know, you guys are doing at St. Jude's Retreat, when somebody wants to leave and when somebody needs to go somewhere else, they want to leave their environment, is what I'm trying to say, and go stay somewhere else, that there are places like St. Jude's and there are different levels
yeah.
of places. And that now with what you're doing, do you still do one-on-one coaching?
No, I don't. I stopped doing that when I started working for St. Jude's.
Uh-huh.
I was doing sort of my own method with some life coaching and some educational stuff that I had written personally. And then I was working with Stanton using his life process program with that. But no, I'm not doing that. I'm working exclusively for St. Jude's. Instructing their program, and we're also working on revisions to the program right now.
Yeah, we had Michelle Dunbar on a couple weeks ago. It was really nice to have her on. And
oh yeah, that's
yeah, have her
right.
talk about her personal story. Well, we are almost at the end of the show. We have about a minute and a half left. We have been talking with Stephen Slate, and you can go to his website, The Clean Slate. And you can also go to St. Jude's Retreat website. But Stephen actually has, you have a Facebook page. I think I'm going to put one up too. We talked about doing this. The Clean.
Yeah.
Your cleanslate.org, are you? Or what's
The Facebook page is The Clean Slate. It's facebook.com/theCleanSlateAddictionSite. And
okay.
My blog page is thecleanslate.org.
Very good. And to everybody out there in internet, listen land, chat land, blog talk radio land, so I'm getting so nasally, I'm going to run and get some more tissues. I was fine. Oh, my God. But it was really a pleasure. Really a pleasure having you on, as always, and talking to you.
Great.
I want to thank you so much. We'll have you on again and look forward to getting the word out and letting everybody know about Stephen Slate, the clean
slate. I think
slate.
What you're doing, I think the strategy you've taken, which is let people know there's alternatives, is just so much better than, you know, okay, we know AA's scummy. You know, but I think that's the way you're really going to create change, is really spreading the alternatives.
Yeah.
Kudos.
We want people to know. We really do.
Yeah.
We want people to write more books and get the books out and put the signs on the backs of buses that there are these other options. And so those other options are empowerment. It's a behavior. It's not a disease. And there's a ton of them. So thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you for being my guest tonight. And we'll see you all next week when I have another fantastic guest. Thank you so much, Stephen. All right. Take care.
Thank you, Monica.
All right.
You too.
Take care.
Bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.